This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to a new episode of Science with Dr. Carl in your podcast feed. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for listening. This week, we got into some great conversations. We talked about the smell from decomposing food. We had a question about mushrooms decomposing bodies. And we also chatted through the ways breast milk can be used as a cure for ailments. All of that and more in this week's episode. Let's start with one of the biggest news stories of the week. We are about to launch into Science with Dr. Carl. Carl, how you doing?
Ever so peachy keen.
Now, an hour and a half ago, 9:35 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, NASA's Artemis II mission lifted off. Space agency hoping to send humans around the moon for the first time since 1972. Some real historic moments with this as well. The four astronauts include the first woman, first person of colour and first non-US citizen to travel beyond low Earth orbit. Carl, what can you tell us about this mission and about this liftoff?
Well, firstly, we've had a continuous outpost in space since 2000. The 2nd of November 2000, we have had humans living in space continuously, but only 400 kilometres up, which is less than the distance between our capital cities. So they're not far away. This is the big one, trying to live on the moon. And there are two ways to look at it. One is that this is part of a well-coordinated long-term plan to get ourselves a foothold in space. The other way of looking at it is that this was a hodgepodge of a project designed to provide employment for politicians in America who were at risk of losing their place in the next election, and so they funneled a lot of work into their area, and so that's how there's a lot of work done to build up the Artemis. They're the two extremes.
Okay.
The Artemis has been a bit of a kludge.
What do you mean kludge? What does that mean?
Okay, so they're using four main rocket engines to boost it into orbit. Those rocket engines were incredibly expensive and they were designed to be reused.
Mm.
And they got a lot of them left over from the space shuttle. And instead of coming up with new rocket engines or reusing them, they're throwing them away. They're just dumping them in the ocean, which is a waste. And then, but on the other hand, they are going to the moon, which I think is a good thing for various reasons. They're playing it very safe. They're going to go into orbit, which is where they are now, and then they're going to stay in orbit and then boost to a higher orbit and then check out things on the spacecraft because, remember this, it has got several hundred thousand parts, each of which was supplied by somebody who offered the lowest price. In other words, in every case, they go for the lowest quote. And so that's a bit scary when you're sitting on several thousand tons of liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. They did get into orbit. And so they're going to do a figure eight orbit, which means if you look at it from above, they do a loop around the Earth and a loop around the moon and back again. And once they fire the rocket to get to the moon, they don't need that rocket again because they were playing it safe. And if that rocket refuses to fire again, they're screwed. So what they've got is a figure eight orbit so that the gravity of the moon, and we're following Newton's equations, we'll just take them around the moon and then slingshot them back to Earth and it's perfectly safe. And then they've got another little rocket they can fire to get back and do a watery landing as before. But to actually land on the moon is a whole different thing and far more complicated. And the Americans did it in stages, testing things each time. There is a slight worry. We talk about this in our podcast on the ABC, The Challenger Legacy, where we deal about things that blow up, for example, the Challenger spacecraft and the Columbia.
Hmm.
And there are people, and when I say people, I mean NASA engineers and ex-NASA astronauts who say that the heat shield is not safe enough. So they're coming in at 10, 11, 12, 13 kilometres a second. You've got temperatures of thousands of degrees C. The spacecraft is made of aluminium or aluminum, as the Americans foppishly call it, and it's protected by a heat shield. And it's brittle and bits broke off. And they're saying that the method they chose for Artemis II to get the space capsule back down to the Earth, they said it's not safe. So most people say it's safe, but there's a significant number of engineers who are saying it's not safe. I hope it's safe. I hope it works out for them.
You and me both. There is a live feed going on ABC News right now if you want to check it out. They cover what the toilet situation is like, what they're going to be eating.
Oh, I wonder how they do it.
How the spacecraft returns to Earth.
I think the toilet is basically a very large plastic bag with double-sided sticky tape. And you stick around your buttocks.
Works when you're camping, pouches, right?
Yeah, and there's little pouches where you can grab the feces and toss them down to the bottom because they don't come off automatically. On the space station, they've got a fan that pulls the feces down.
Really?
Yeah.
They, yeah, Yep, they'll be collecting pee in bags.
Yep.
It's a travelling toilet, which is now set up within the aircraft.
Oh.
They just set it up in the air.
Really? So they've got... Okay, because the toilet is a whole lot of weight and it's got a... So what happens is the feces come down and they then they hit a spinning rotor disc. So, yes, literally, the feces do hit the fan and they get sprayed into a thin layer on the International Space Station on the inside of the toilet bowl, and they seal the top and open the bottom to space, and they say there's nothing more beautiful than a urine dump at sunset and it's freeze-dried and odourless.
Wow. Yeah, they've said it's similar to the one on the International Space Station.
That's a lot of extra weight.
They just had to, yeah, set
You're
it
kidding.
Up while they were in orbit.
I really thought they were going to use a double-sided sticky tape on a large plastic bag.
Hey, has it worked for you? Have you ever done it?
I have never been lucky enough. I actually got my start in the ABC by trying to become an astronaut and failing, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a question. Let's kick it off with David in the Riverina. David, you've got a question about... you know, the atmosphere, what's going on?
Yes, good morning, Lucy and Dr. Carl. My question is about, thank you. My question is about the Earth's atmosphere and the role it has, the Earth's magnetic field and the role it has in retaining our atmosphere. And did Mars used to have an atmosphere, and what changed for it to be inhospitable now?
The solar wind is exactly the problem at the root of the problem you're talking about. So every second, the sun throws out a million tons of charged particles in all directions. So a million tons is a lot per second, but then space is very big and not very many arrive at the Earth. But rather than just sort of ripping straight through the atmosphere and down to the ground, or ripping our atmosphere off, as has happened to Mars, we have a magnetic field. The magnetic field is parallel to the ground at the equator and stays parallel to the ground practically all the way up until you get to the north and south poles, and then it dives down. Essentially, the Earth's magnetic field protects the Earth's atmosphere by stopping the charged particles ripping into the atmosphere and tearing it away. That is not the case with Mars. Mars does not have a significant magnetic field, and that's the main reason that it has lost its atmosphere. Its atmosphere is 0.6% of the Earth's atmosphere, and it's mostly carbon dioxide. So is that what you're asking about?
Yeah.
So that was the pathway that the planetary scientists think, or at least it did a year ago when I read it. And if there are any planetary scientists who've got a new, up-to-date observation on that, please ring 0439.
And that is the text line. So text in 0439 757 555.
0439. The 757 is easy, and the 555 is because that's JJJ on a keyboard with letters on it.
Thanks, David. Does that help for now?
Yes, thank you very much.
Excellent. Aaron in Wollongong, changing gears here. What's your question?
Hi, doctors. I was very lucky to be able to breastfeed my baby for an extended period of time. And a doctor once gave me advice that if there was any little rashes or scratches or cuts, to pop breast milk on it because it heals. And it always worked. And I was wondering how that works and why.
Erin, my sister did the same thing with her son. He got a little scratch on his face and she popped a, just dabbed a bit of breast milk on it, and it got better pretty quickly.
It's amazing.
Dr. Carl?
Well, it's amazing that you can convert a baby from a little 3.5 kilogram lump to a heavier lump purely and in perfect health with every bit of nutrition they need, macronutrients, micronutrients, water, everything, just from the breast milk alone. It's astonishing. So it's more than just milk. So standard milk, you know, from the cow, is about 85% water and then fat, protein, carbohydrate making up the rest. In breast milk, whole different thing. Firstly, there's antibodies. So any protection that the mother has against various illnesses will to some degree be carried across. There's different antibodies involved, IgA, more so than the other ones. And so there's antimicrobial factors. There's anti-inflammatory things. There are growth factors there for the breast milk to help the baby grow. There's a minor antiseptic effect. And for some unknown reason, and I guess it makes sense, that there would have been an evolutionary pressure to be able to protect the mother as well. So basically the mother is the only source of life for the baby. In fact, I had a backup plan for that in case we end up in trouble when we were doing our early days in outback traveling and Mary, who was breastfeeding the baby, we had an accident and she got killed. And I had a backup plan, which I read from Indigenous stories.
What was the backup plan?
For some reason, I completely bypassed the idea of getting milk and powder. I didn't even think about going to the chemist. No, I picked a much simpler way. If you go out into the desert, you find a small animal, you kill it, you get its brain, mush it up with water, and it has pretty well... Yeah. I don't know why I didn't think about just buying prepackaged milk.
You said we're going to live off the land.
Well, I don't know. But so it makes evolutionary sense as well that it can protect the mother, who is the only source of nutrition for the growing baby.
Wow. Does that help, Aaron?
It does. Thank you so much.
Amazing.
And did you find that it actually works? Does it heal things better?
It was incredible. My little one had some colic issues, so struggled with some nappy rash, and the breast milk was by far the best thing that worked.
I had never thought of that, but wow.
God damn.
Yeah.
Thanks,
breast
Aaron.
Milk for nappy rash.
Yeah.
It was amazing. 10 out of 10 recommend.
We'll recommend.
Wow. You learn something new every day. Thank you. Wow.
Lucy in Melbourne, your compost bin, it's smelling. What's going on?
Yes, hello, dogs. So my question is basically, why does compost smell so bad? Because I love the smell of a ripe banana or a ripe mango, but the second it goes into my FOGO bin, it smells rank. So why does, fruit and things like that smell so bad when it's composting?
Ah, maybe it's not composting fully. So I've got two compost bins, one that's resting and one that I'm loading, and I try to turn them over every second day or so. And I am still amazed that all you do is you just chuck in vegetables and a bit of paper, including newspaper. You need to chuck in paper and a bit of torn up cardboard because you have to get the nitrogen in there. And the inks, apparently, on newspaper, if you still read newspapers, are okay for the compost, and it doesn't smell. If it smells, it's not a happy compost. But you end up putting in vegetables and newspaper and worms come out of nowhere and turn it into soil. So you're talking about a FOGO bin that's a little bin that you then hand on to the council and they turn it into a big composting site?
Yes, yeah. So I palm off my fruit scraps.
Right. That's a good thing to do. And I'm kind of thinking that maybe there'd be a way you could – I actually, to get one of my bins started, I went to a hardware store, wait for it, and I bought some worms. Did you know you can buy worms at a hardware – how come you knew that? Have you bought – why would you want – Lucy, why would you want to buy worms when you're at a hardware store?
My parents have bought worms to feed to magpies. They're in dust, so they buy little worms to feed them.
Right, okay. Okay, so maybe what you could do is throw the worms in there, but you'd need to throw in a bit of soil, and I'm guessing you probably live in an apartment and you don't have the surface area to have a composting area?
Yes, unfortunately, I'm in a share house with a very little backyard, so not much space.
There is a book that CSIRO put out about composting, and I'm guessing that what's happening in your case is that the bacteria are taking over. And I'm just trying to think if there's another way. Could somebody who's a greenkeeper, these people know so much, ring us, text us on the number 0439 757 555, and tell us the way to get around and solve this problem. There is a solution, I'm sure.
It is pretty awful when the bin, it's summer and the kitchen or the room is really hot and then you open it up. Awful.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Lucy, thank you so much for your question. We're on the journey now. Dr. Carl, I promised that the best question in this episode would win a Triple J prize pack. Do you want to contribute anything?
I would like to throw a book in there as well as a luxury German sports car, block of flats and Lord Howe Island.
Hey, you're getting all of that in the mail if you send in the best question.
Okay, we lied a little bit about the last bit.
Maybe just the book, okay? If you've got one, it's creative, it's fun. 0439 757 555. We've had some great ones so far. And we just had Lucy texting in about the smell from her compost bin. Mm. A lot of you coming through with some really great options. Kylie in Bega, you cut banana skins into strips and no more smell in your chook bin. You said, I don't know why, but it works like magic. Someone else suggesting lime. And another person who's gone direct to the source, I think from Monash University, saying to stop a green bin from smelling, layer food waste with dry materials like cardboard or garden prunings to absorb moisture and use compostable liners for your kitchen caddy. But you use the compostable liners and they do still kind of have a little bit of an odour.
Yeah.
I think it's just replenishing it pretty frequently.
That's right, before the bacteria get in there, or have different bacteria. Can you colonise it? I think it's too rough for the worms to get into it.
I'm seeing as
bulky.
Well, keep the bin in the shade, sprinkle baking soda to neutralise odours.
So long as it doesn't, you know, make it useless for the next stage, which is going into the big composting. If somebody can tell us about that, thank you.
We're learning so much. Connor, in Ngunnawal country, you're keeping us in the kitchen. What is your question?
Howdy, howdy, doctors. I've got a question about soap suds. A little bit of backstory. Every time I'd wash the dishes up after dinner at home, my family would give me a bit of lip because I'd add the dish soap after running the water. And so, like, there's obviously no soap suds because I didn't want to have to rinse them off. They believe that it's more effective cleanliness-wise to put the soap in first. But from the research that I've done, soap suds they're only an indicator, and it's actually probably a marketing strategy for companies. So I wanted Dr. Carl's take on it and what his opinion is.
Oh, my God, I love that big dish soap. What's going on, Dr. Carl?
Okay, I haven't been bought out by big detergent. And you've basically hit the nail on the head, Dr. Connor. So the soap suds look attractive, and yes, they're a very nice marketing tool, and they may help deliver a tiny amount of soap to the surface. Yeah, but really the soap's already there, and you're dead right, they do make it harder to do a clean rinse. So when we're doing the hand washing, we have two sinks side by side and a little one with the clean water, and so we just run it through into the clean water and then there's no soap left behind it. So you're dead right. You don't need these soap suds. But if somebody can answer this question for me, with some soaps, as they get very small, they still keep on giving a lather. Others, they give as much lather as a bit of rock. Can some chemist please ask me? I've tried asking professors of chemistry at the University of Sydney and they've all said, I don't know. So if somebody can answer that, I would love you to pieces. But Connor, you are doing it the right way. You are right, and your family is being unfair to you, but they're probably doing it out of love.
So it doesn't matter if it is a sink full of suddy water or whether it is just kind of chucked in and still being... Okay.
And you can tell when the soap is doing its action by how it removes the various things on the plates, and then you're getting a little bit of a colour sheen as you hold up to the light. So you'll know when you're running low on the soap and the soap's all been consumed, the detergent's all been consumed by the grease that happens to be there. By the way, with grease, what I do is I wipe it with paper and then feed it to the compost pile.
Mm.
Because that way I'm getting the extra nitrogen and I'm stopping the fat from going into the ocean.
That's good. Connor, does that help?
Absolutely. You guys are legends. Absolutely made my day.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You take this, you get the podcast and you take it to your family, okay?
Yeah, play it back on over and over.
Yeah. Connor, thank you so much. We've got Stuart in Maitland here. Hey, Stuart, you got a question about silicosis.
I do. Hey, guys, how are you going?
Good, you clean?
That's good. I was just wondering about, with regards to silicosis, that horrible disease that people get when they work with manufactured stone and sandstone. I was wondering why people that live in parts of the world where they get massive sandstorms, why they don't all have silicosis.
My God.
You see whole cities completely swamped by sand blowing in off the desert.
That's like...
You know, I was wondering why the whole population don't suffer from silicosis.
That could have been a whole through line in the Dune series.
Oh, my God.
The Fremen. Is it the Fremen? They could have been wiped out by silicosis with all that sand.
Mm. Yeah.
But in the real world, Stuart, you're right. What's going on, Dr. Carl?
I definitely do not know. I have read up on silicosis, and it is a frightening disease, and it can come on very quickly. And every time I walk past a building site and I see a worker with an angle grinder and a cloud of concrete dust around them. That is just so bad. And you should do wet grinding, not dry grinding. I suspect, but I do not know, but I strongly suspect that if they have lots of sandstorms in their area, that they will have a slightly higher increased rate of silicosis. So there's two different types of sand. There's the sand that you get in the deserts, where you have the particles moving at high speed but light pressure. And they tend to be rounded off. And so you're thinking that the bumpy bits of the sand particles have been blown into the air and can go into people's lungs. Just a little aside here. What you really want for construction is not sand from the desert. We are actually having sand wars around the world. In the Middle East, when they build things out of concrete, they get the sand mostly from Australia. They actually, to build the Palm Island in Dubai, they used up most of the available sand that they could find in the Red Sea. And so it was built by sand, with sand from Australia. So if you have the sand moving at high speed with low pressure, it rounds off and you get the smaller particles in the air, no good for construction, but good for or bad for causing silicosis. Underwater sand moves slower, but at high pressure, and that leaves it all bumpy. And then that is perfect for linking in to make concrete. So I do not... Look, if there's somebody who does occupational health, you would know, and you'd be able to tell us about the silicosis. The trouble is that the people who live in the sandy areas are often poorer, and so they wouldn't reach the health system.
Yeah, I thought it might be particle size or even some sort of inherited resilience to it. Don't know.
Yes, Stuart, you've got John in Darawal Country texting and saying sand is the wrong size for the disease, and Dom also saying the same thing. I suspect it's because the sand from the desert is much larger grains than the very fine dust from manufactured stone.
Yeah, that makes sense. But what about the process of when, so I guess it already has been turned from rough particles into smooth particles in the past, and it's just the big particles being blown around now, I think. Occupational health, come on down, people, we need you.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you, Dr. Stuart.
Thanks, guys.
And we've got Jack in Wagga Wagga here. Jack, we've gone from the desert,
morning.
Now we're gone to the ocean. What's your question?
Morning, doctors.
Good morning.
My question is how does the saltiness in the ocean stay uniform across the world? And if the salt is heavier than the water, why doesn't it just sink to the ocean floor?
Okay, so I'll do the second one first. So people have said, oh, you can't possibly have global warming because carbon dioxide is heavier than oxygen, so it would sink to the bottom. Well, nitrogen and oxygen have different weights, and yet they're in equal proportions in the atmosphere because we've got mixing. We've got mixing from 1 kilowatt of power landing on the ground from the sun, when the sun is directly overhead, heats the ground, heats the air, goes up, mixing. And we have the same sort of mixing in the ocean. Now, in the oceans, we also have evaporation. Roughly 1 metre of ocean water is evaporated each year, goes into the clouds, moves around, falls as rain, comes back into the ocean again. So you can have local areas where you've got more evaporation than in other areas, but overall the salt concentration is the same. The salt comes from what are called oceanic ridges. So there are places where the tectonic plates, there are a couple of dozen or so plates that carry the continents, that move between 2 and 10 centimetres a year. Your fingernails do about 3 centimetres a year. And when they pull apart, you can have the molten magma rising and then freezing on the ocean floor, and you can have what are called hot spots, hot oases, black smokers. All those terms have been used, where the salt, the sodium, comes from below in the ground, the sodium and the chloride, and they, as salt, they go into the water, and then they dissolve. They dissolve, so the sodium ions go here, the chloride ions go there, and they don't all sink to the bottom because it's at a temperature above absolute zero, so you've got mixing. Now, if you've got an awful lot of evaporation and a very shallow gulf, you can have the salt level there a bit higher than in the ocean outside. And in the past, we've had the tectonic plates move around so that at one stage, we had a supercontinent basically in the southern hemisphere going east-west, and a little bit later, we had a supercontinent going from the North Pole to the South Pole. And in that case, I think that was either Gondwanaland or Pangaea. That one that went north-south, there was a huge gulf that was very shallow, and it would dry out at low tide and then get wet at high tide. And we have massive salt deposits in the land up to 10, 20, 30 metres thick, left over from that in the past. So is that kind of answering your question, or have I missed the boat there?
No, that answers it. No, thank you.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you. And turbulence is the answer. Turbulence causes everything.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, Dr. Jack.
Thank you.
Hey, we had that question about silicosis versus sand.
Yes.
Vivian in Ngunnawal country saying the particles in sandstorms are much larger than those from grinding manufactured stone, so the fibre particles are inhaled to more distal areas of the lungs. Someone else saying, I thought silicosis was caused by the bonding agent used in manufactured stone. Is that it?
I would have to look it up, but my understanding, which could be wrong, is that it comes from the actual silicon dioxide particles being very small. And the point that our previous texter raised about the particles being smaller, you normally in air pollution talk about particulate matter, you know, this small stuff, as PM2.5, meaning 2.5 microns. That's a millionth of a metre, a micron. Your hair, about 50 microns, okay? So there's PM2.5s and PM10s, they're 10 microns, and you're dead right, the smaller ones penetrate more deeply, and I hadn't realised that the sand grains are too big, and then you get part of the way down, then you get irritated, the cilia in your airways bring it up, and then either you swallow it, so it goes into your gut and comes out the other end, or you sneeze and cough it out.
They're
much bigger, I hadn't realised that, than the particles in silicosis.
Now, earlier, Dr. Carl, we got a question about the smell that you can get in a compost bin, why it's there, and we're getting a lot of tips on how you can prevent it. A horticulturalist, KB, has texted in saying bacteria stinks when conditions are incorrect. The carbon-nitrogen ratio should be 25 to 1. If worms are in the bin, it's not a compost bin, but still good. Don't put large pieces in, not too much of citrus, meat and dairy. Mix it to incorporate air.
And the carbon nitrogen is 25 to 1.
Mm.
So you should add a bit of paper. How you measure that?
I don't know.
But anyway, it shouldn't smell. So there is hope. You can do the right thing by the environment and not have a stinky kitchen.
We've got Tom in Boogong here. Now, Tom, you've got a question about ants.
I do. It's a little bit of a random one. Morning, doctors.
Morning.
Good morning, Dr. Tom.
So we've been doing just fencing and bits around the yard, and sometimes inadvertently an ant might get squished in the process. And I can smell that very, very clearly, but my partner thinks I'm crazy and she can't smell them at all. I was wondering if that's like an olfactory thing or a sensitivity thing.
I can smell them, Tom.
Really? Mm. Firstly, there are differences between people, but there's a very small percentage of people who are super smellers. And they tend to head down a pathway, if they're lucky, of being in an environment where they can get a job as a sommelier or something in the vineyard area. There was a famous case I mentioned before of a woman who could smell something called Parkinson's disease.
Mm.
And so after many years of being married to her husband, she noticed he started to smell bad. And then about 12 years later, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. They went to the self-help group with all the other Parkinson's people, and she could smell the smell as she got out of the car. And it's been proven that she can smell it, and now they've developed an artificial nose that can smell it. So you may well be a super smeller as well, or you might have a new career smelling wines.
But do you know what that smell is, Carl?
I think it's formic acid, and there are advantages in being able to smell it because in general you don't want acids on your flesh or your body. So, but I don't know. I've run out of steam on that one. So but I'm putting it down to individual differences.
But the ants, do you know what the smell, do you smell the ants?
Yeah, I smell them.
Yep. Yeah.
And I try not to crush them.
I know.
It's so cruel.
Mm. Okay. Tom?
It's formic acid.
Awesome.
We don't know why.
Cool.
Maybe you could be a superstar.
Not crazy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You're not going crazy, Tom. Don't worry.
You're normal.
We've got Brad in Halliday's Point. Now, Brad, tell us about your son's birthmark, what you've noticed.
Morning, doctors. How are we?
Good.
Very well. Thank you, Dr. Brad.
That's the way. So my son, he's 18 months old now, right? When he was born, the doctors said, yeah, it's from the forceps. It's like a bruise.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of weeks later, it wasn't going away, and they said, yeah, it's a birthmark. I forget the name of the birthmark.
Cafe au lait?
No.
Not that one. Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so as time's gone on, the birthmark has, it looks like it's disappeared, and but that hair where the birthmark is like black, like the colour of the birthmark. Would that, would the hair be sucking that colour of the birthmark out, or what's
no.
go there?
So how big was the birthmark, like a fingernail?
Oh, no, definitely not. It's, I'll put your index and thumbs together.
Oh.
It's about a circle that size, yeah.
Wow. So, and it faded away? And did they say it was yep. due to a blood vessel abnormality or a dying abnormality, a pigment?
No, nothing like that, no.
Because okay, sometimes you can have what's called an arteriovenous abnormality, where the arteries, instead of going through an organ, just go straight into the veins. And so you get the blood vessels opening up and you get the colour. So almost certainly it was an error of pigmentation, and this can happen. And
yep.
The pigment in the skin comes from the melanocytes. So if you imagine a street of, like in Europe, of cobblestones or an old city in Australia, and in between the cobblestones you lay these long skinny ropes, and they're the arms of the melanocytes which yep. release a chemical called melanin, and we're talking a different pathway from the hair colour, and this chemical then goes into the skin cells as they're growing, and as the skin cells die, it gets sloughed off. So when you expose yourself to sunlight, you increase mm-hmm. the production of melanin. It goes into the skin cells, and while you're still exposing yourself to the sun, the skin cells will show that dye. They'll die after about 14 days, and then if winter comes and you stop exposing yourself to the sun, then you lose your tan. The hair colour is completely different. There's a factory that generates a shaft of keratin, and then there's a little like outpouching at the bottom where there's a sub-factory that injects a different type of melanin into the hair shaft. So the colour of the birthmark is different in general from the colour. They could be the same colour, but they're generated. The dyes are generated by different pathways, and the dyes themselves can vary as well. There's different types of melanin, pheomelanin, eumelanin, et cetera, et cetera. So it's more complicated than just melanin.
Yeah, okay. And the hair, it grows probably 5-6 times quicker than all the other hair on his head, which isn't much.
Wow.
But
That is amazing. And when you say the hair, it's just like a single hair?
No, like the patch or where the birthmark was, yeah.
And how big is the area where the hairs are, like the size of a little fingernail at the moment, or is it shrinking? Is it staying the same?
No, it's all the same. It's, yeah, the size of the what the birthmark was.
But you're saying that the birthmark has been shrinking or the colour has been fading?
Yeah, the colour's like gone right. out of the out of his head.
But in that patch, the hair is growing 5 times faster. Definitely
yeah,
do
yeah,
not
100%.
Know. And
yeah.
in fact, a friend of mine has just had breast cancer and then went through the hair treatment. I said, and I noticed, oh my God, your hair has changed. He said, yep, along with everybody else who goes through the, not everybody, but many of the people who go through the anti-cancer treatments. I do not know the answer to that one either. There's so much homework you've given me today. So things are getting better with your son?
Yeah, we don't have to have any more checkups, which is good. But yeah, the doctor said it's all good, so.
Yes,
yeah,
good.
Great.
What do they call that, Dr. Carl? They call that kissed by an angel or something? The birthmark on the head?
Oh, I'm going to have to look it up. I've forgotten all my dermatological stuff way long ago.
Yeah, I think, I think you're right,
kissed
Brad. It's
angel.
Something like that, kissed by an angel.
Oh, that's sweet and romantic. Yeah. Isn't it lovely?
No, it's pretty good because he didn't get to meet his grandmother, so.
Aww.
Yeah, I reckon she's done it for him. Has to.
Oh, Brad, that's beautiful.
That's lovely.
Aww. Very
awesome.
Sweet.
Awesome. You guys have a great day and thank you very much.
Thank you so
thank you,
much. Yeah, we'll have to look into that hair growth rate. Dave in Emerald. Now, I've never heard of this experiment that your son's doing. What's going on?
Yeah, so he loves doing experiments at home, and he's got one where you get an egg and you put it in a glass of vinegar and then you leave it for a few days and then the egg becomes sort of bouncy. And you can squeeze it, and it's sort of like a squishy ball sort of thing, and you can squeeze it to a point that it explodes.
Cool.
So we were wondering, yeah, why this happens.
Ah, how old is your child?
He's 7.
Oh, well, get him to go on to drcarl.com and make a booking for his school, and we'll do a free science Q&A with his school, which we do every Wednesday afternoon. Costs you nothing, do it for anybody anyway. So that's one thing. Secondly, there are websites or there are TikTok areas where they specialise in experiments for kids, and some of them are devilishly simple, and you learn so much from them. Thirdly, in this case, you've got two things. You've got the calcium carbonate, which, if anything, is slightly alkaline, and the vinegar, which is slightly acid. They react, and the calcium atoms go away from the actual shell. The carbonate turns into carbon dioxide, and some of it can go inside the egg. Does the egg tend to expand a little bit and become a little bit more?
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah.
So that's the chemical reaction. So you're getting the calcium carbonate reacting with the acid to create a base plus carbon dioxide. And this is a very neat experiment. By the way, the egg, on average, the eggshell has something like 70,000 holes. And so as the chicken is growing, turning from a white and yellow gloopy mess into a cute little chick with fuzzy hair and a beak and eyes and little feet and everything. To let that happen, you've got to have metabolism going. And carbon dioxide goes out through the 70,000 holes and oxygen comes in. So,
wow.
Yeah. Those holes will go away and now you're just left with the membrane. So the shell goes and you're just left with this membrane, but the carbon dioxide travels into the egg and then bulges it out, and there's enough structural integrity in the membrane so that if you drop it from a low height, it bounces. Drop it from a high height, it just goes splop.
Fantastic. All right, well, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Dave, and I want to try this experiment. Sounds so fun. Hey, thanks, Dave. We had that question earlier about the smell of ants.
Yep.
Josh texting in this saying birds perform anting. They let ants crawl on their feathers to release formic acid, whose strong smell helps repel parasites like lice and keep their feathers clean.
Oh, my God.
That is so interesting.
You learn so much every day.
Sean in Newcastle, what's your question?
Hey, Dr. Carl. My question is, so my brother Josh has always given me a hard time because I like me deli meats. I like a bit of gabagool. And with all the preservatives in them, he always tells me that it's just going to increase my chances of getting things like stomach cancers. And then I kind of got my tinfoil hat on and I thought, well, the more I look into it, it seems that things with lots of preservatives just often get linked to causing cancer. And I'm just wondering if there's any link between, you know, anything organic being preserved and causing cancer.
There are many ways to process foods, you know, smoking, curing, nitrate, nitrites, salt, et cetera, et cetera. And with salami, there's a very slightly increased risk, which is that if you have, say, 50 to 100 grams, like a small tin of sardines, every day, then your risk of getting not stomach cancer but colorectal cancer rises to somewhere between 1.1 and 1.5. So if you're having like a big lop of it every day, like having a tin of sardines worth every day, you're getting a slightly increased risk. But in general, most preservatives have either been tested to be safe or they fit under the category of GRAS, which means we haven't tested it officially or formally. It'd be too hard, but they're generally recognised as safe, GRAS. A bit of a cough there. So then, no, they do not all cause cancer. Maybe the nitrates and the nitrosamines. And also you can find problems with stabilisers used in some yogurts to give them a sort of delicious creamy mouthfeel. They can interfere with the layer of mucus on your stomach and that changes the makeup of bacteria in your gut but not necessarily give you cancer.
Oh, okay. So I guess just you can have a bit of gabagool and whatnot, but just not too much.
In moderation.
That boring in moderation again.
Everything in moderation. Oh, it's so always boring. That, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks, Sean. We got Indigo in Brisbane. Indigo, what's your question?
My question is how many mushrooms would it take to decompose a fully sized human body in a year?
Wow.
That's very interesting. And Wendy Zukerman actually runs into that. We don't have a lot of time, but I'd recommend listening to her podcast from Science Versus on decomposting human bodies. And it's actually quite difficult to compost yourself. And if, for example, you want to be turned into a tree, and so you get yourself buried in the ground, you plant some trees above, that doesn't actually work. This is a very big and complicated topic. Mushrooms, well, they are a fungus. Rather, they're the fruiting body of a fungus. So if you... Then there is a body farm in Sydney, by the way, where they lay out bodies and see what happens to them. So I reckon that mushrooms would break down a body fairly quickly, but it varies enormously. So I don't know how many mushrooms you'd need. And it wouldn't be so much the mushrooms, but they are the fruiting body, so that would work, yeah, I guess.
And how long, do you reckon?
It varies enormously. Like the first thing in the article was on TV, somebody says, oh, that body's been there for exactly 3 months. And they said it can be anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 months.
Wow.
It just varies enormously from person to person, and also the sunlight, et cetera, et cetera. But listen to that Wendy Zukerman podcast on Science Versus about composting human bodies.
Good rec. Got that Indigo?
Yep.
It'll be homework. We'll check out next week to make sure you've done it, Indigo. We know where you are.
Hey, for this week's episode, we're giving away a prize pack to the best question. Dr. Carl, I have chosen my winner.
I was very lucky to be able to breastfeed my baby for an extended period of time. And a doctor once gave me advice that if there was any little rashes or scratches or cuts to pop breast milk on it because it heals. And it always worked. And I was wondering how that works and why.
Erin in Wollongong, great question. And I loved your answer, Dr. Carl.
And I love the fact that Erin told us you could use it, let's inform the audience once again, to fix up
any cuts and or nappy rash.
Nappy rash. I had never heard of that.
Amazing.
That's amazing. Erin, you rock. You thoroughly deserve whatever it is that you're getting.
A Triple J prize pack. You're going to throw your book in, Dr. Carl?
Yes, book number 48.
Yeah,
Science and memoir. Yeah.
Love that. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Dr. Carl and I will be away next week, but you've got Bianca Negrete filling in and Sam Lane who will be joining you. Make them feel welcome. Send in your questions for next Thursday on 0439757555. This episode was produced by Matteo Bascarin. My name is Lucy Smith and we'll catch you later. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.